Trust relies on three key elements, and this is what I call the golden triangle: independence, mandate, and accountability of central banks. And each of them is being challenged today.
In this episode, we hear the Michel Candessou Central Banking Lecture presented by François Villeroy de Gallo, governor of La Banque de France. The theme, the ethics of currency.
Today, we central bankers are responsible for trust. We produce it and we stand accountable for it.
François Villeroy de Gallo has been governor of La Banque de France since 2015. He's also member of the European Central Bank Governing Council and chairs the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva introduced the event.
In October last year, when we had our annual meetings, many of us were quite upbeat. Growth was coming up strong. We ended the year with 6.1% growth. And vaccines gave us the confidence to expect that the pandemic is over. So we thought inflation that we were experiencing would go away. And we were proven wrong. Wrong when Omicron hit. Wrong when Russia invaded Ukraine. Wrong when, during this summer, climate shocks have affected dramatically agricultural productivity in many places, and we are likely to suffer that further in the future. So inflation is stubborn. It is more broad-based than we thought it would be. And what it means is that we need you, François. We need central bankers to be as stubborn in fighting it as inflation demonstrably has been. We are mindful that you are on the front line. And all in this audience, we are with you. And of course, we at the IMF work relentlessly to provide the analytics that can help us steer through this time of uncertainty. So let me welcome you to the floor. We admire what you have done with macroprudential policy, build buffers in France, they helped with COVID. We admire your leadership on the network for greening the financial system. But above all, we are pleased that our speaker today brings some of Michel Candessou with him. They're close friends, and apparently Michel Candessou participated in the thinking for this lecture. So with François, we get him and Michel Candessou for today. François, bienvenue.
Dear Kristalina, dear Tobias, dear friends, because I have only friends in this audience, thank you very much for your kind words. Maybe too kind, but we'll see. And thank you for inviting me to give this council lecture. It's a very great pleasure for me, for all the reasons you mentioned. And I would like to take this special opportunity to pay a tribute to Michel and express also, yes, my personal gratitude. Michel is not only one of my predecessors as a governor of the Banque de France, but also a friend of mine. And yes, I must confess it, in front of his family, Camille and Nicolas, Michel is more than a predecessor, he's a master for me. My speech was prepared, you mentioned it, Kristalina, with his precious help. And to give you some fresh news from Michel, although he's now 89 years old, he's fit and well. I spoke with him still on the phone on Saturday. He conveys his best friendships to the IMF and to all of you. And today you can almost enjoy a Cansu lecture by Michel Cansu himself, because we prepared it. So all what is good in my lecture will come from Michel. All what is bad will come from me. This is the rule of the game. The somewhat unusual theme I proposed for today, the ethics of currency, has guided Michel throughout his career. I thought that in the murky waters we all are navigating through today, it was good to take some altitude, to take a step back. And ethics of currency should more than ever serve as a golden thread. I will first briefly discuss the reasons why I dare to talk with caution, modesty, about this ethics of currency. Then I will elaborate in practice on the golden triangle of trust. And finally, I will raise the very important question, especially here, as to whether the international dimension of trust can still inspire us. Let me start with some brief theoretical considerations and etymological. We must find a common definition of ethics. Is it possible to take this word as a synonym for morality? For centuries, these questions of ethics and moralities has mobilized generations of philosophers. Supporters of the synonym theory highlight a common etymology between the two words. Morality is a Latin translation of the Greek ethos. The two words, nevertheless, have followed different paths over time. Morality can be described as a hard concept, similar to the fundamental rules engraved on Moses' stone tablet or in the Code of Hammurabi. In contrast, ethics refer to a softer and less binding concept, a kind of existential version of morality with a more personal dimension. I will use the word ethics in that way in this speech. Let me give a noteworthy example, the question of interest rates. It went from a moral prohibition in the ancient times to a more flexible and ethical approach. From a moral overall ban, ethically fair interest rates have been progressively distinguished from usury rate, with the latter still being forbidden. Homo economicus, as we all know, invented currency very early in human history, and it is striking that almost as soon as currency was born, countless abuses were seen as well. Manipulation of gold or silver weight in coins, including sometimes by the sovereign himself, skewing of scales, and so forth. As early as in the 4th century BC, Aristotle famously identified the three functions fulfilled by currency. I reassure you, I won't take my whole lecture speaking about the Greek ancient times. But Aristotle complemented this brilliant theoretical approach and very early one with ethical guidelines opposing unnatural crematistics or personal enrichment and virtuous economics, oikonomia, literally household management, to the benefit of this entire community. And this very simple distinction can still be very useful for us. I jump to the more recent times. With the acceleration of historical transformation, the 20th and early 21st century have been particularly rich in the emergence of economically ethical issues. The Great Depression led to protectionist reactions, which themselves led to economic disasters. A powerful inspiration reacted in turn by trying to bring back order in monetary affairs and, yes, multilateralism in international ones. I will come back to that in my third point. In the 70s, however, neoliberal thinking, inspired by men such as Friedman or Hayek, caused a swing of the pendulum. In Hayek's opinion, for instance, this is striking, trying to subject finance or the economy to ethical principles was a waste of time. Today, after new crises and with the emergence of fresh concerns, the pendulum has swung again. To give just one example, environmental concerns have acquired an essential ethical dimension. Let me add a last, somewhat theoretical distinction or consideration between the ethics of money and the ethics of currency. The ethics of money are customary and widespread. They can be summed up among many other quotations by the words of Alexandre Dumas II, a famous French writer. A small parenthesis about French literature. We have two Alexandre Dumas. The father is the most famous one, is the author of The Three Musketeers. But the son was also a writer, and he wrote, I quote him, "Monet is a good servant, but a bad master." This is probably the best sum up. The ethics of currency that interest me today are obviously part of this ethics of money. But they are less common, and they have two specific features. First, the importance of institutions, of the sovereign dimension. There is no currency, let me stress it very strongly, without a public authority that guarantees it and is responsible for it. By the way, this is why there is no such thing as a cryptocurrency. And second, the importance of trust, which can be defined as being able to count on the character, ability, strength, or truth, yes, truth, of someone or something. Today, we central bankers are responsible for trust. We produce it and we stand accountable for it. Such a responsibility entails a strong personal component. Our behavior has to be flawless and driven by real functional requirements and high ethical standards. But let me today focus on the institutional and collective foundation of trust and come to my second point about what I call the golden triangle of trust. And here I will put this principles I mentioned in practice. Let us try together. Trust relies on three key elements, and this is what I call the golden triangle: independence, mandate, and accountability of central banks. Some may take them for granted, but they are actually the result of a long historical progress, and each of them is being challenged today. First, independence and this long historical quest with a current calling into question. It took a long time for trust in currency to be dematerialized, to move from trust in a physical medium, gold and silver and metallic currencies, to trust in an institution. The 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution, saw the expansion of banking and finance and the creation of many central banks. It was a first decisive step. A dedicated guardian was put in charge of issuing banknotes as the first, at that time, immaterial currency. The second decisive step, and we know it, it's mainly from late 20th century, in the 80s and 90s, was to make central banks independent from political power in order to ensure the stability of the currency. But independence, which I cherish, does not mean isolation. The context of the Russian war in Ukraine challenges us to reinvent the dialogue with political authorities for at least three reasons. Because geopolitics are today a major determinant of the economy, because the energy markets, their regulation and pricing are key for inflation, and lastly, because fiscal choices regarding subsidies to households or even to firms are far from neutral for monetary authorities, and by the way, for the IMF, we discussed it this morning. Another challenge to independence, and a more tough one, is that the populist ideology creates an atmosphere of general mistrust of institutions, and still more of independent ones. At worst, this would call into question our democracy and its necessary checks and balances. At the very least, it is imperative for us to be efficient in our mandate and to increase our accountability. And let me come to the second corner of the triangle, efficiency of our mandate. Price stability, which is a prerequisite for long-term growth, is the primary objective of most central banks. Broader mandates, nevertheless, apply to some, notably the Federal Reserve, with its dual objective. Other central banks have expressed sensitivity to, say, climate change or to inequalities. Some observers question this alleged mission creep and wonder whether central banks have lost sight of their primary responsibility. Against this backdrop, I tend to refer to Max Weber's distinction between ethics of conviction and ethics of responsibility. Ethics of conviction is a driver for a broad mandate, but also to a risk of overpromising. Ethics of responsibility is a driver for realism and a more focused mandate. Our Eurosystem answer consists, as you know, of a clearly hierarchical mandate with one primary objective, price stability. But if fulfilled, we can and must contribute to the secondary objectives of, I quote, also the European treaties, economic growth, social cohesion, and the environment. Let me clarify that the Eurosystem's strong commitment to fight climate change is motivated first and foremost by its profound implications for price stability, and we could discuss them this later, through impacts of climate change on the economy and on the financial system. In other words, when we are acting decisively against climate change, we are acting in the very name of our primary mandate. I spoke about efficiency of the mandate, and here obviously we are challenged. Inflation has accelerated significantly over the past year, reaching 9.1% in the euro area, and we saw it yesterday, 8.3% in the US. Monetary normalization is consequently fully warranted, including in the euro area. It's too early to tell the final interest rates in this journey. But the neutral rate, R star, helps us to give some light on the first part of the journey. I believe it in the euro area to be estimated as below or close to 2% in nominal terms, and we could be there by the end of this year. Until then, we definitely have to act in a determined but orderly way. Doing so is normalization. Only beyond R star would tightening begin if needed. The US is obviously closer to tightening. Due to several differences in the nature of inflation across the Atlantic, the monetary answer must have its differences too. But in both cases, let me stress that, it's not only a legal duty, it's also an ethical commitment from us central bankers. Ensuring price stability is our responsibility, our will to deliver, and our capacity to deliver on our mandate cannot be subject to any doubt whatsoever. Turning to the third corner of the triangle of trust, accountability, you remember that famous sentence attributed to Alan Greenspan, quote, "I know you think you understand what you thought I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant," unquote. This provocative sentence certainly captured the difficulty for central banks to account for their monetary policy. But let us be clear, it belongs, or it must belong, to a bygone era. No matter how complex, it is central banks' duty to account for their monetary policy decisions in a comprehensible manner. Accountability is the natural, the obvious counterpart of independence. And this necessary change, which is a challenge, has both a cyclical and a structural component. The cyclical component pertains to the way we can combine agility and predictability in a very uncertain environment. We should be careful not to return to secrecy or to unnecessarily add to financial and economic volatility. Otherwise, as research at the Banque de France shows, economic agents may begin to question our ability and commitment to fulfill our objectives, which could translate into disanchored long-term inflation expectations. I suggested in my recent Jackson Hole speech some principles for what I call this new predictability. Let me put it this way. Not having a forward guidance does not mean, cannot mean, not having a narrative or a monetary strategy. The structural component of the accountability challenge is that our communication must not only resist the risk of political dominance or market dominance that would run counter to our independence, but also resist two additional risks that appear more specific to the current period. The first risk is the dictatorship of short-termism imposed on us by a recent series of crises. Of course, we have to deal with this crisis, but we must not become a prisoner of emergencies. We must continue to focus on the longer term, also in keeping with our role of advanced sentinels. Central banks rely on their close monitoring of all financial and economic indicators and also on their anticipation of how they may evolve in the future. The second risk is that of corporatist fragmentation. It is, we all know that, the other disease of this century. Of course, we are not responsible for it, and we are not corporatists, but we could be sinning by omission, by passiveness. Contrary to a long-standing approach, whereby central banks only dialogue with financial specialists, we must now direct our communication at all economic agents, including the general public. A better informed society across categories allows for a better understanding of monetary objective and hence a greater efficiency of monetary policy. Tailored and active communication is now a centerpiece of central banks' actions. To give you the Banque de France example, which I know best, in 2021, we initiated the Banque de France Listens initiative. It included 17 events with an audience, including online, of more than 300,000. This year, we organized our annual National Monetary Policy Forum, reaching an online audience of 500,000. I come to my third and last part. Does the international dimension of monetary trust still exist? And this is obviously a core question here. It has become, let us say it frankly, a painful question. With the ongoing destructive Russian war in Ukraine, adding to the other illnesses of multilateralism in the last 6 years, from Brexit to populism and poorly disguised protectionism. Let us acknowledge it frankly. The G20 is not in good shape. Whereas it had been key to great progress over the last 20 years. And sanctions against Russia divide the G20. It is still hotly debated whether these sanctions are necessary and efficient, or, on the contrary, whether they are counterproductive for the countries that initiated them. I believe that we should stick on this issue to a few simple facts and principles. A, the surge in the prices of raw materials, primarily of oil, dates back to rumors of war and then to actual invasion in February, not to the sanctions that followed that invasion. B, in the short term, the Russian economy seems to be losing less ground than expected, precisely because of that surge, but its long-term growth potential is obviously greatly weakened by technological sanctions. C, there are moments where what is ethically fair prevails over what is economically profitable. Even if, in the short run, there may be contradictions between the two, a sustainable economy cannot exist without an ethical basis. But, I stress a bit, justice also enjoins us to deal with the situation of the poorest countries and people in this Ukrainian crisis. The world's community drive to achieve unity while respecting diversity should nevertheless remain widely recognized as an essential aspect of the pursuit of the universal common good. The tale of the euro in the last 30 years is particularly inspirational in this regard. In present adverse circumstances, we should assign top priority to a few courses of action. Let me call it focused multilateralism or pragmatic multilateralism. It obviously, and you mentioned it, Kristalina, it obviously includes climate. But I will today concentrate on two other issues. First, designing a consistent framework to ensure that crypto assets do not undermine confidence in the financial system. They bring positive technological innovations. But here, global regulation under FSB's umbrella is key. But it cannot be central banks' only answer. It has to be accompanied by their own innovations. The main rationale for central bank digital currency is to preserve the role of public money in a fast-moving economy. But with the aim of avoiding further international fragmentation, we have to pay special attention then to cross-border interoperability of CBDCs, and hence to wholesale CBDC, not very frequently mentioned, in addition to retail CBDC, as a way to ensure this interoperability. The second paramount priority of action is to reposition the IMF as a pivotal stakeholder at the very heart of the Global Financial Safety Net, GFSN. Today, IMF resources account for a smaller share of this GFSN. But there has already been significant progress, the last general allocation in August 21 of $650 billion. It was, to quote you, Kristalina, a shot in the arm for the global economy at a time of unprecedented crisis. And let us remind that it was before the invasion of Ukraine. However, we know there is a challenge. Developing economies are the primary users of SDRs, and they have benefited much less from the general allocation. About two-thirds were directed at developed economies as a result of existing rules. Reallocating, rechanneling SDRs is crucial. The G7 commitment taken up by the G20 to bring this reallocation to 100 billion must be kept and implemented quickly and efficiently. We are not yet there. Part of these allocations have been allocated to the PRGT fund to finance low-income countries. Still, we have to find additional resources to finance a subsidy account of the PRGT. Another part of these reallocations, 37 billion at this stage, is about to become reality by IMF annual meetings in October. We strongly wish it, thanks to the newly created Resilience and Sustainability Trust. I am sure I agree with the MD in wishing the RST to be higher in its amounts, quicker in its disbursements, and not too conditional in its provisions. And these are three possible messages today. And we have to care not only about the lending capacity of the RST, but also about demand for RST facilities. France will be true to its word, and we will reallocate at least 4 billion SDRs, representing at least 20% of the SDRs we received. More generally, the IMF must play a greater role in crisis prevention for vulnerable countries. This is even more pressing in the present context of unstable geopolitics, looming food crisis, commodities price volatility, and more frequent natural disasters linked to climate change. I therefore welcome the recent proposal of a new food shock window, but here again, it must be increased. Our efforts should not stop there. Let me conclude coming back to the Greek philosophers, and this time Sophocles. He wrote, "Trust dies, but mistrust blossoms." Let me stress that trust as a shared treasure also has a key human foundation, which we have passionately built over time. I sometimes call it the immaterial treasure. International meetings in Basel at the Bank for International Settlements, and thank you, Kristalina, for mentioning it. I have the honor to chair it, and I had the pleasure to be in Basel with Tobias and with others 2 days ago. Or here in Washington at the IMF, are not places for mundane agreement, as some sometimes think. They are forums for true dialogue. By building on a common diagnosis, by discussing openly, frankly, our concerns, we know that in these forums, we won't be leaked, we won't be instrumentalized, we won't be distorted. This is the only way for trust to prosper, and this is how we will progress together. Michel Cansu himself has symbolized this value of humanity like none other in his personal behavior and in his human relationships. I thank you for your attention.
I do believe I speak on behalf of everybody in this audience and those online saying this was an incredibly substantive and somewhat uplifting, because while you describe reality pretty well, you also brought this sense that we can come together. And yes, there may be pain, but because we are together, there would be less of it. Our hero today, François, you get our round of applause and our gratitude.
That was François Villaroy de Gallo, governor of La Banque de France, presenting the 2022 Michel Camdessous Central Banking Lecture. Go to imf.org to watch the webcast of the entire event, including a post-lecture discussion with Kristalina Georgieva. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.